Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that we've got over there. And while you're over there, make sure that you check out the Northwest Arkansas Regional event, April 16th and 17th. It's $65 for a two-day event. Chad will be there. I'll be there. A whole bunch of other people will be there. If you are able, we would love to see you. There's a link in the show notes that you can click on to see that as well. Chad, we are in 1 Samuel chapter 25 today.
Yeah, it's I was mentioning before we started, this is a chapter that's full of drama. It was a lot of fun to work my way through it. I learned a few things along the way, so it's going to be a pretty cool story to cover. It's kind of a strange story, only because it's sandwiched between two accounts of David and Saul. So it's just kind of seemingly thrown in there. And some people say, well, it's placed here because, of course, David ends up marrying the woman who's the subject of this chapter, or it's placed here because this happens while David is in the wilderness on the run from Saul, all of which is true. But I think another reason that we have chapter 25 between the two stories about David and Saul is because the bad character in this chapter, Nabal, or Nabal, however you want to say his name, is kind of a... he's a Saul-like character, let me put it that way. His personality, and not just personality, but some of the things he says and the way that he treats David, and even David's initial deference to him, all seem to be very much like Saul. So I think that's another reason that we have a pretty long chapter, actually, devoted to this guy that we've never really heard about before, just kind of jumps into the narrative.
I think sometimes if you look at the way that the story is going, sometimes they give you a little break just to have a break in the because otherwise you'd have like this David spares Saul like back to back, and I think it's a good move to make you look at something else before going and looking at something that's very similar to what you just looked at.
Yeah, that is true. It's kind of one of those meanwhile back at the farm kind of stories. Yeah, that is true. And another thing I like about it, just apart from the whole narrative side of how it functions, is it does reveal a different side of David. In many ways, it's almost a prophetic glimpse into who David could become if he's not careful, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
because we'll see at one point he reacts or is about to react very much in anger. In fact, he's going to act almost like Saul does. So you have this glimpse into a side of David that we really haven't seen before, and how he can react to just kind of without giving thought to what the repercussions of his actions are going to be. So, you know, we've kind of had this one-sided picture of David so far. We meet him when he's just a young shepherd, and the next thing you know, he's out on the field killing Goliath, showing this courage, and then the next thing you know, he's just all of a sudden the leader of all of Saul's forces. And then while Saul chases him, he's always wanting to be on the side of innocence and righteousness. So we've really kind of seen one side of David. This narrative is going to reveal a different side of David, which as he becomes king later on, and then we get into 2 Samuel, we'll see that side of David is still there and just kind of waiting for an opportunity to present itself.
Yeah, I think that is, you kind of realize that we don't know that much about David at this point, other than he kills Philistines really well and he runs from Saul really well. Like Saul hates his guts. There's not a lot of parts of the story so far that reveal anything other than those things about David, right? I mean, like his he breaks on the scene with Samuel anointing him king, and then immediately we're giant slaying, and then from that point on, like you said, it's just like this rise in military status, and then you have Saul's suspicion, and now he's running from Saul and that kind of stuff, but There's not like this like some story in there about where David is doing something. We haven't seen him engage with very many people. We don't even really know how he does engage with people. The only people he engages with are Philistines to kill him and Saul. And the most human sort of regular interactions we see him have has been with Jonathan, but those have been pretty brief. And so I think stories like this sort of paint a fuller picture for you when you're dealing with someone like David, as opposed to just a highlight reel of victories and crazy situations where he's in caves and Saul's in there and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So for all those reasons, I think it's a good chapter. It's a good chapter to study, of course, but also kind of a chapter to tuck away in the pocket of your memory, as it were, to think, oh yeah, I remember that. Remember that side of David from back in 1 Samuel 25. So anyway, let's get into it. Before we actually get into the story proper, there's a one verse announcement about the death of Samuel. That's the way the chapter starts. And it really is. It's just one verse. It says Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned for him and buried him at his house in Ramah. So not really anything else has told us about that. There's nothing really else to say about that. We've heard plenty about Samuel up to really the last couple of chapters. So we know about him and his youth. We know about who he became. And now we hear about his death. We will have one more very weird encounter with Samuel much later on. We'll get to that in a few chapters. Then the verse concludes by saying David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. And this is where we re-enter this episode in David's life. We're first of all introduced to one of the main characters of this chapter. But the funny thing is, just as far as the way he is introduced, is we're not told his name until after we're told about all his possessions, which when you read the rest of the story is quite purposeful. The way it starts out is by describing basically where he lives and how much money he had. There was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. Now Maon is west of the Dead Sea, and Carmel is in that same area. So this is not Mount Carmel, the one that's a mountain on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. This is a different place, so don't get those two confused. This is south of Jerusalem, and just a little ways to the west of the Dead Sea.
We'll get to Mount Carmel in good time.
Oh yeah, we will get there. another story for another day. We're told that this guy was very rich, and he was rich in livestock primarily. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. That's a lot of livestock. So the reason we're introduced to him in this sort of way, the reason we're told he is wealthy, is because it's his stinginess with his wealth that's going to become part of the story. But that's why he's introduced the way he is. And we're also told that he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Evidently, sheep shearing was a time for parties. We know from other biblical narratives that when you sheared your sheep, it was just a time. Of course, you were working, but also it's kind of like a harvest. You know, it's also a time for rejoicing, for partying because of the gifts that God has given. So in this case, it's sheep instead of agriculture, and they're shearing their sheep, and they're going to be having this feast in which they rejoice over God's bounty to them. So all of that is presented first. It's fronted in the narrative, and only after that do we hear anything about who this guy is and anything else about his character and his wife. So verse 3 says the guy's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. And then we have a description of the two of them. And it's pretty hard to imagine a more opposing description of two people. The woman, well, she was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, and the man was harsh and evil in his dealings. And then we have one more phrase. It says he was a Calebite. So a couple things about this. First of all, it's a little bit ambiguous as to whether we should understand this guy's name. So in Hebrew, it would be pronounced Naval. And Naval is the exact same word that's used throughout the biblical narrative for fool. So a fool is a Naval. Now, some people think maybe this was a nickname that was given to him. His real name was something else, and this just happens to be the nickname that the biblical narrative chooses to describe him. Other people think that Naval is maybe based upon a different Hebrew root that means something positive instead of fool, because it's kind of hard to imagine. I mean, it'd be like a mom and dad having a baby boy these days and naming him stupid. I mean, no, who would do that?
Right.
Yeah. But we're not exactly sure. Is it a nickname? Is it a Hebrew root that has some positive meaning? But whatever the situation might be, it is for sure that this guy's name is paralleled with fool, and rightly so, because he will act very foolishly.
Perhaps this is just God being merciful as he inspires the scriptures to be written, and he will give this man a different name and spare him the shame of being a fool. So he will just call him fool, so that he, for all of history, his name is not associated with this. So we'll just call you something different.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe that's what's going on. So we're told about his personality, and then we're told, of course, about his wife. And both of these descriptions are, of course, a very obvious foreshadowing of what's going to happen later. I mean, anytime you're introduced to someone in this sort of way, you know, oh, okay, we know where this story we know where this story is going. It's going to go well for the woman, and it's not going to go well for the man. So you don't even need to know what happens to know what, in essence, is going to happen as it goes on.
You probably need someone to intervene in such a story. That's how these things are usually written.
Right, right. By the way, fun little fact about Calebites. So we know Caleb, of course, from back in the book of Joshua. One of the heroes of that time, one of the few heroes of that time, good guy. Now, this fellow was evidently a descendant of Caleb's line, but there may even be kind of a play on words here, because Calebite can also in Hebrew mean dog-like, which we love our dogs today, but in the Old Testament, dogs had a very bad reputation, so. It's not a good thing to be dog-like in the Old Testament. So anyway, maybe that's a pun on his name. Well, what's the situation? Why are we told about these people? Well, David's in the wilderness, and he hears about this sheep shearing that Nabal is engaged in. So he takes advantage of the opportunity to send some of his soldiers to Nabal, basically in order to kind of pay up. We'll find out about the situation as we read on. So David picks out 10 guys and says to them, here's what I want you to do. Go up to Carmel and visit Nabal and greet him in my name. And this is what you're to say to him. Have a long life. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. So peace, peace, peace. And then he goes on. Now I've heard that you have shearers, and your shepherds have been with us, and we have not insulted them, haven't abused them, nor have they missed anything all the days that they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son, David. So this seems to be the situation that David and his men have been out in the wilderness. Of course, there's a bunch of them. There's 600 of them. So David's got quite the crew. And they find these shepherds who happen to work for this rich guy. And they more or less just kind of, you know, keep an eye out. They make sure that, you know, nobody's mistreating them. Nobody's stealing into their sheep. Nobody's doing any kind of harm to them. So they've just sort of volunteered to be their protectors while these guys are out in the wilderness. Now, was this done from completely selfless reasons? Probably not, because, you know, David is pretty shrewd. He's probably thinking, yeah, you know, if I keep an eye on these shepherds, then maybe I can ask for something in return from the guy that they work for, which exactly, of course, is what's going on here. David knows they're having this huge party. He knows Nabal is rich, and he probably realizes that his men are hungry, if not getting hangry at this point, because it's a lot of mouths to feed. So he sends this delegation with, I think, a very diplomatic, a very kind request. More or less, hey, you know, we know that you're having this party. We've been doing good for you. So, you know, whatever seems right to you then please do that to us. You know, they don't come demanding, hey, we want you to give us 10 donkeys full of supplies. They just say, whatever you find at hand to give to your servants, please give it. But, that's my reading of it.
Yeah. David's an interesting mind. Because this seems like, if I'm looking at it from one vantage point, from Nabal's vantage point, I would be like, well, I didn't ask you to do this.
Yeah.
It'd be like if I was having a party and some people showed up and they were like, hey, man, we've been out here and we made sure that no one touched any of your cars. So we didn't scratch them. We didn't steal them. I mean, you know, we could have took your cars. We have a lot of guys here, but we didn't. Instead, what we did is we made sure that nobody messed with your stuff. So, you know, if you got anything for us, that would be great. This is it's an awkward situation to be in.
It is very awkward.
Because you're like, well, you're providing a service that I didn't think I needed, or else I would have taken care of it. But then you're also not really demanding anything. You're just sort of stating this is the case. But it does seem like sort of implied in there as well is, hey, we're good guys. You know that. Not because we really helped you in this way, because obviously you don't think you need this particular help. But I think implied in there is that we could have been bad guys.
Yeah.
And done something different, right?
Definitely, definitely. I think it's implied in sort of this triple peace, right? Peace be to you and peace be to your house and peace be to all that you have.
Yeah.
And there will continue to be peace as long as you respect our request.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's too strong to call it a veiled threat, but there certainly is a hint of that kind of tone to this particular language. So, yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on whose perspective you look at it from. I mean, if you're looking at it from Nabal's perspective, he might think, well, we're going to hear his perspective very, very shortly. He's thinking, listen, I don't care who you are. I didn't ask you to do this. I'm not giving you anything. If you look at it from the perspective of the shepherds, and we will hear their perspective in a minute, they're like, our boss is an idiot. These guys were like a wall of protection to us the whole time we were out there. So they're like, of course you should give David and his men what they need.
Yeah, and could have been a wall of something else.
Yeah, I mean, they could have. There's 600 guys. If they wanted to butcher two or three sheep every night,
they didn't have to ask.
They didn't have to ask. You know, what are the shepherds going to say? No. So you have David's perspective. You get the shepherd's perspective. You got Nabal's perspective. And of course,
it is a little bit like walking into McDonald's, like cleaning all the tables and asking for a paycheck.
Yeah. 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 So some commentators have likened this to protection money. This is the mafia showing up. You know, hey, we've got your back here.
I work here now.
I work here now, so pay up. Well, anyway, let's see what happens. David's young men, verse 9, David's young men, they came and they delivered the message, more or less, according to all these words, in David's name. That's repeated. So David wants to make sure he knows these aren't just 10 guys showing up. They are the delegation sent from David. And then I love there's a three-word phrase at the end of in the verse 9, and they wait. Then they waited. I don't know if that's in the ESV or not.
Yeah.
But, it's almost like there's a gap. I'm like, I don't know any other reason why the biblical narrative would have included that phrase, then they waited, unless it was like they gave their speech and then just kind of standing there.
Yeah, there's a pregnant tension.
Yes, right, right. Like there's this pause, like they give their speech and you just kind of see the scene. They're standing there. Nabal's listening. They give their speech and he doesn't respond.
Yeah,
So they're like, okay, what's happening? So then they wait. And then the speech, oh my goodness, the speech. Wow. You almost find out everything you need to know about this guy from these two or three verses. I love the way he starts out. He answered and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? And then he has this insult. He's already insulted, but goes on. There are many servants today who are breaking away from their master. Whew. And then verse 11 is impressive only because within a span of one verse, Nabal manages to include not three or four, but eight first person pronouns. So I, my. This is a, if there ever is an ego verse in the Bible, this is it. Verse 11. He goes on, he says, shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shearers and I give it to the men whose origin I do not know? So in the Hebrew, there are eight my's or I's there. So this guy is, well, needless to say, all about himself. Listen, this is my stuff. I own it, and I'm not going to be just giving my stuff to these guys. I don't know where they came from. So,
yeah, I think it's kind of important to point out that he is most likely lying here, because first of all, he says, who is David? David is not somebody at this point that people don't know about. If you're some rich, powerful guy, it's very unlikely that you haven't heard of David. And he does know who David is because he says, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? The son of Jesse is not part of the speech.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He obviously knows who this guy is.
But they didn't say, give whatever you have to your son, David, the son of Jesse. This is not part of the, so not only does he know who David is, he knows who his dad is. I mean, he knows his lineage. Mm-hmm. So he does know who that is. And this sort of, in the ESV, I do like the way it says it, that as he goes through this I thing, it says, you know, shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shears and give it to men who come from I don't know where?
Yeah, which is actually the literal Hebrew there. Yeah. Come from I don't know where. Yeah, so...
And isn't there something implied in this, is that there are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters, basically implying that he knows that David's on the run from his king.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a not-so-subtle reference to the fact that, oh, yeah, David, you know the one, yeah, that one that broke away from his master who's rebelled against the king? Yes, yeah, that's a not-so-subtle reference to David's situation.
Yeah, it seems like what is happening here is David's men show up, be like, hey, we've been giving you your shepherds this protection you didn't ask for. We didn't have to give it to them. Could have just taken what we wanted, and but we didn't. So, you know, whatever you could spare would be great. It seems that he's coming back with, look, how about I just report you to Saul?
Right. This is true. Like a lot of other people were doing.
Yeah. I mean, there's this sort of, you know, if there's a little bit of like strong arming by David being like, you know, be cool if you acted cool, man, because, you know, we treated you right out there. Yeah. He's saying like, yeah, don't come in with like a veiled threat or anything, because I actually do know who you are. And I do also know that someone's looking for you.
Yeah, exactly. So that's his speech. Let's see what David's reaction is going to be. Well, the delegation, they go back and they report to David everything that Nabal said to them. And David's response is instantaneous and violent. He says to his men, each of you put on your sword. So each man put on his sword and David put on his sword. And about 400 men went up behind David while 200 stayed with the baggage. So you don't need to know exactly what the plan is of David when you have three. It's kind of a cool thing here too. So David said peace, peace, peace three times in the speech that he gave to his men to repeat. And now we have a threefold reference to sword. So we go from peace, peace, peace to sword, sword, sword.
It seems that one of two things or both are happening here. One, that this request was not just a, hey, if you want to give us something cool, if you don't, that's cool. That there was this not so veiled, you need to give us something. We had 600 dudes out here. There's either that, because this response is quick, like that David feels like, okay, well, I guess there's not going to be peace then, because we'll have to do it the hard way. There's that. Or is this or this, or it, or this as well, that this sort of the statement by Nabal that, hey, a lot of servants have left their masters, basically like I'm about to sell you out. Like I'm about to tell your location. Yeah. Is that so? I tend to think this is not, it's one of those things, but it's both of those things that mm-hmm. David's plan probably always was, look, if this guy's going to act like a fool, then we'll just, we got to go. I got 600 mouths to feed here. So I'm trying not to go do it this way. And then this other not so veiled threat on top of it makes it be like, okay, everyone strap on a sword. We're doing this right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. It's both. I mean, he's reacting. He's going to take what he wants, but also he realizes that this guy could very well turn him over to Saul.
Yeah. And this also tells you that I think that David doesn't quite believe that him and Saul are just fine, even though we left them and it seemed like things were like getting better. But I don't think David's David knows Saul well enough to know that he shouldn't put too much faith in that change of disposition that he temporarily saw.
Right. Yeah. There's very little trust that's lost between those two. So now we're introduced to the actions of Abigail, verse 14. One of the young men goes and tells Abigail what happened. They say, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the fields. They were a wall to us both by night and by day, all the time that we were with them tending the sheep. So we have, this messenger basically saying, hey, David's a good guy, and they did good things for us while we were out there. And then he has verse 17. Nobody likes Nabal. Verse 17, he goes on, now therefore no one consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and against all his household. And he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. This worthless man translation, by the way, we've seen it before. This is the son of Belial that we encountered multiple times so far. This guy's everybody knows he's such a son of Belial that nobody can have any kind of discussion with him. So the servants don't like their master. They know he's a worthless guy, and they're extremely concerned, as well they should be, because they realize that this refusal on Nabal's part to help David is going to do nothing but bring about a massacre when David shows up with his men. So this is the report, and now we're going to hear how Abigail responds to this. This chapter could be entitled "How a Wise Woman Stopped an Angry Man from Doing a Stupid Thing."
Yeah, and then in parentheses it can say "Always have a crap ton of bread on hand."
Yeah, right. Yeah, she's gonna make sure these angry guys who are probably also hungry are going to be pacified in more than one way.
There's a lot of bread.
There's a lot of bread, a lot of bread. So she hurried and took 200 loaves of bread. I suppose they were getting ready for this big feast at the sheep shearing time. So they take. She's grabbing the bread, two jugs of wine. Smart lady, get some alcohol in there as well. Five sheep who had already been prepared. So, maybe they're roasted or whatever. And then five measures of roasted grain. And then 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and loaded them on donkeys. That's a lot of donkeys. That's a lot of food.
That's a lot of food. If that's all the food, you were getting ready for a huge party.
Yeah.
Like if that's not, I don't know if that's all of it or just part of it, but...
Just part of it, yeah.
That's a lot of food to have on hand for a party.
Yeah, yeah. So she's raiding the pantry. She's loading the donkeys. She's getting ready for quite a gift that she's going to give to David and to his men. She says in verse 19 to the young men, her servants, go on before me, and I'm coming after you. And then we have this loaded phrase, verse 19, but she did not tell her husband, Nabal. So she's... again, a wise woman. Same phrase, by the way, that's used earlier, chapter 14, when Jonathan did not tell his father Saul what he was engaged in. When he was about to do that heroic attack upon the Philistine garrison. He didn't tell his dad what he was about to do. And here, Naomi does not tell her husband what she's about to do. So she sends the young men ahead, and she comes riding on her donkey, coming down on one side of the mountain, the hidden side of the mountain, and then David and his men were coming toward her. So it's kind of they're converging on this mountainside when she meets them. And before this, this is sort of a back speech. So this David isn't saying this like right at this moment. So David had said, so earlier, presumably, this is a speech maybe he gave after he told his men to strap their swords on their thighs. Surely in vain I have guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. And he has returned me or repaid me evil for good. May God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave as much as one male of any who belong to him. Couple things of interest here in the Hebrew. At the end of verse 21, this returning evil for good, repaying evil for good, I checked, and that same expression, well, the first time it occurs is in Genesis chapter 44. But David, in three of his psalms, uses that same expression. So Psalm 35, 12, 38, 21, and 105:9, that same expression is used in those Davidic psalms to describe how his enemies have treated him. So I'm thinking this is probably a favorite expression of David's, and he includes it here in this prose narrative. Secondly, and somewhat comically, it says, if by morning I leave as much as one male of any who belong to him. Now, Hebrew has a strange expression. Perhaps if you grew up with the KJV, with the King James Version, maybe you're familiar with this. I think the King James translated this at one who pisses against a wall.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in fact, my English translation, the New American Standard, has that as a footnote. I think this, almost vulgar expression is included here because I checked, I think it occurs five or six times. It's all in the books of Samuel and Kings, and every single occurrence is in a situation kind of like this. Like when you're pronouncing a curse or a threat of destruction on some group, and it says that, like, every male will perish. Every single time, that same expression is used to describe it. So it's sort of a pejorative way of referring to men.
Yeah, you're saying everybody who pees standing up.
Yeah, everybody who pees standing up is going to be cut down, more or less. But it's not like, it's not an expression you'd probably use in everyday speech. It's something you use when you're threatening to basically mow down all the men of a place.
You're the Hebrew scholar here, Chad, but it does seem like the implication is that you would pee standing up, but you are going to be cut down. And it's the standing up versus cut down. There's a contrast, and the Hebrew is like that. I mean, Hebrew likes to do that sort of stuff, right?
It does. Yeah. I think that's what's implied there. Yeah. So, you usually stand up? Well, you're not going to be standing up for long.
Right.
You're going to be laying prone on the ground. Okay. So that's the speech that David had delivered. Now let's return to Abigail. Abigail sees David. She hurries, gets down from her donkey, falls on her face before David, and bows to the ground. So she's wanting to make it obvious just by her actions that she has come to beg for his mercy. She falls at his feet, and here's her speech. She says, "On me alone, my Lord, be the blame. And please let your maidservant speak to you and listen to the words of your maidservant. Please do not let my Lord pay attention to this worthless man, Nabal. For as is his name, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now, therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself," or saving yourself is another translation, "by your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek evil against my Lord be as Nabal." Pause there just for a second. This is a long speech on her part. She's a smart lady. She starts out right away by, as it were, directing David's attention away from her husband and toward herself. So he's probably taken aback at first, like, what do you mean? What how could this be your fault? Right. So she probably throws David off a little bit. She says her opening words are, "On me alone, my Lord, be the blame." Well, of course, David blames Nabal. So he's probably thinking, what does she have to do with this? And then she goes on multiple times to call him Lord, Adon, Adon, Adon. In fact, 18 times in this chapter, that particular word is used for Lord or for master. So she is humbling herself before him, and she's begging him to listen to her. And then she makes this subtle shift. So she's talking about her husband, and she says, don't pay any attention to him, because he's basically living down to his name. His name is Folly. It's not exactly Naval in the Hebrew. It's Navalah, which is folly, foolishness. It can also mean an outrageous act. But she's more or less saying, yeah, you know, that's his name, and that's the kind of character that he has. But then she makes this shift in verse 25. She wants to, it's very clever. She starts out by, as it were, taking the blame, but then she very quickly wants to make sure that David knows that she's not the same kind of person her husband is. She's like, oh yeah, yeah, my husband, I know, he's a fool. But listen, I didn't know that these young men came from you. I had absolutely no idea that this was going on. So she wants to separate herself from her husband as well. And then she goes on to say that God is more or less working through her to restrain David from bringing blood guilt upon himself.
Yeah, I think this is a really wise move. The initial statement of, hey, it's my fault, the blame be with me, this is a good move, because it means that you have a pause. Because once you say this, David now has to listen to what you're about to say, because what you just said is reason to, it gives you reason to listen. If she just came and, you know, rode up and said, please don't do this thing, I'll give you food, he might just be like, too late, out of the way, we're going in. Mm-hmm. But when you say, it's all my fault, you're going to listen to that person. So it buys her David's ear.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. She's a, I mean, I don't know if we encountered a woman far that is quite as wise, as clever, as shrewd as Abigail is. I mean, this speech is just is gold. Let me finish it out, because she goes on for a while. She said, now she refers to the gift, all this food. Now let this gift, which your maidservant has brought to my Lord, be given to the young men who accompany my Lord. Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant. Again, she's done nothing wrong, but she says, please forgive me. For the Lord will certainly make good for my Lord an enduring house. In other words, she knows what is in store for David. She knows that God is about to place him on the throne. Goes on, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you all your days. And then verse 29 has got to be one of the most poetic expressions we have in the whole Bible. Should anyone rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, then the life of my Lord, meaning the life of David, shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling. This is such an image. So the bound in the bundle, there's various ways this has been understood, but it seems to be that you have like a little sack or something, and you're tying it up, right? You have a bundle of something, whatever it is, maybe it's coins, maybe it's something else, and you're tying it up. And she's saying, may your life be like that, bound in this bundle of the living with God, which is an amazing metaphor to use. It's safe, it's tied up, it's bound. Then she makes the contrast. So may your life be like that. But anybody else who's against you, may they be like a stone that's placed in the hollow of a sling that's about to be thrown away from the Lord.
I feel like she knows who she's talking to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There is no doubt in my mind that the story of what David did with Goliath is well known to Abigail, and she's thinking, you know what? I think the best way that I speak to David is like this. I'm gonna draw from his own life in order to describe what should happen to his enemies. Let me just quickly finish this up because we're out of time. Verse 30 and 31, she says, when the Lord accomplishes for you everything that he's spoken and he makes you ruler over Israel, then I don't want there to be any grief or trouble because of bloodshed that you have done in the past. And then when the Lord has dealt well with you, then remember your maidservant. In other words, I don't want you to do something now that you're going to regret. This trail of blood that's going to follow you to the throne. So don't do that. Don't kill every male. Instead, just leave off. And then she throws this in. When you become king, well, remember me as well.
Yeah, which of course David, maybe he doesn't have to wait that long to remember. But it seems to me like what she's asking him to do here is, she's like, my husband, he's a fool. Don't be like that. This is not the wisest thing to do. Because I mean, in truth, David's very angry in this situation.
Yeah, yeah.
It does seem that going and killing every male in this house or this party or whatever he's planning to do, that does not seem just.
It's a very, in fact, it's a very Saul-like thing to do.
It is,
right? Like
very
he did to
much.
All the priests at Nob. Yes.
Yeah. So this is, she's saying, look, she says, like, I'm trying to save you from blood guilt, which is another way of saying that you will be guilty of something here. This is not a justified action that you're about to undertake. And I guess we'll have to wait until next week to see how David responds. It's a pretty compelling speech. I think it's as good as someone can do. So we'll see.
I think so too.
We'll see
what happens the rest of the chapter.
Yeah, we'll see if David heeds the words of Abigail or not. All right, Chad, I will see you then.
All right, see you then.